This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading research medical schools. Icon Mount Sinai is the academic arm of the 8-hospital Mount Sinai Health System in New York City. It's consistently among the top recipients of NIH funding. Researchers at Icon Mount Sinai have made breakthrough discoveries in many fields vital to advancing the health of patients, including cancer, COVID and long COVID, cardiology, neuroscience, and artificial intelligence. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way.
Before the show starts, I'd like to ask you to consider subscribing to News from Science. You've heard from some of our editors on here, David Grimm, Mike Price. They handle the latest scientific news with accuracy and good cheer, which is pretty amazing considering it can sometimes be over 20 articles a week. And you hear from our journalists. They're all over the world writing on every topic under the sun, and they come on here to share their stories. The money from subscriptions, which is about 50 cents a week, goes directly to supporting nonprofit science journalism, tracking science policy, our investigations, international news, and yes, when we find out new mummy secrets, we report on that too. Support nonprofit science journalism with your subscription at science.org/news. Scroll down and click subscribe on the right side. That's science.org/news. Click subscribe. This is a science podcast for March 15th, 2024. I'm Sarah Crespi. We have two neuroscience stories this week. First up, freelancer Sarah Reardon asks, why do infants' memories fade? We discuss ongoing experiments that are looking to pin down the hows and whys of infantile amnesia. Next on the show, more brain stuff. Researcher Hui Quan Li is here to talk about how the brain encodes generalized fear. This is a symptom of some anxiety disorders like social anxiety and PTSD. I think my earliest memory is from when I was just about two years old. I'm sitting or maybe walking on this like mustardy brown carpet. Turns out, though, that this is probably not a real memory, but something that I picked up from photos or descriptions of the place I was living right when my younger sister was born. You know, and actually, if I really think about it, I just don't remember anything until I was in school at six. I think it's maybe like one or two back there. This week in science, freelance science journalist Sarah Reardon wrote about this puzzle of infantile amnesia, why we don't remember our babyhoods, a time when we are learning so much about the world, but we still don't remember learning it. Hi, Sarah. Welcome back to the Science Podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So are you going to tell us your earliest memory that you believe is actually a memory?
Yeah, I think I remember our family dog who died when I was three, but it could just be from photos. I definitely remember the Gulf War.
Oh, wow.
So that was actually dateable, but I wasn't very old then. I guess I was five.
Yeah, it's funny how little I remember, and I think some of it's kind of gone away as I've gotten older, but there's definitely a huge chunk that's always been missing. And so I guess the big question to the story, and it definitely makes me think, you know, when our brains are so busy devouring everything, we're learning to eat, to move, to see, to talk, all this stuff we need to remember to get on with our life, we don't remember learning these things. What are some of the explanations out there? What are some of the ideas about why we do forget this key point in our lives?
One thing I learned from reporting that I thought was really fun was that the first person to really coin the term infantile amnesia and study it in any sort of depth was Sigmund Freud. And he, of course, thought that it was because we had this horrible psychosexual experience of being born. We needed to wipe that from our memories or else we would be traumatized forever. And as I talked about in the story, he wasn't entirely wrong. It's not to forget being born, but there is a growing amount of evidence that these memories are suppressed for some reason rather than just not being formed in the first place. So now the question is, how and why does it matter?
So it could be possible that some of our earliest experiences are housed somewhere in the brain, just archived, but just not accessible.
Yeah, that's the thinking.
What are some of the reasons that people besides Freud think that we don't remember this part of our lives?
For a long time, people have just kind of dismissed this as, well, it's an immature brain. Baby's just been born. It's not important that we remember things. And so these neurons just aren't able to form these memories in the first place, or they form them for a little while, then they just get deleted to make room for other things. And that could be true. And then the other hypothesis is that they are formed and they're there forever, but are somehow suppressed to make room for new memories.
I was really surprised to learn from your story that other mammals have infantile amnesia. I guess I just never really thought about whether a kitten would remember or not remember its earliest days. So what does that suggest about what's happening with us if we're seeing these other mammals go through the same thing?
Yeah. And that had been one of the things that people had thought for a long time, was that it was linked to language development, that until we could describe our experiences in words, we weren't really remembering them. But the finding that mice and rats and other sorts of mammals have this as well kind of negated that theory. But it's really interesting. One researcher found that a few what they call precocial mammals, which are mammals that are born with their eyes open, able to fend for themselves right away. Guinea pigs are like that. They're not dependent on their mothers, really. They can just fend for themselves. They don't seem to have infantile amnesia. So maybe everything they learn, they don't have parents around that they can just offload their care and the need to remember things.
So it's much more important that they remember, you know, where they live or what is a scary thing. But this brings up an important point. We're talking about a specific type of memory. You know, we remember how to talk, but we don't remember what we're calling episodic memory, which is what events or happenings or what defines that?
Episodic memory is, it's been described to me as sort of the what, where, when. I went to Disney World when I was 3 years old and I met Mickey Mouse. That would be an episode that occurred in your life. And it's a little hard to study that in animals because they can't tell you what, where, and when. So instead, researchers have been looking at what they're calling contextual memories, which are like when I'm in this box with a patterned floor, I might get a shock if I step over here. And that's sort of a proxy for episodic memories that's being studied in mice.
One of the researchers you talked with, I think they were based in Berlin, they were working with us on this question with a big group of toddlers. What are some of the questions they're trying to find out from working with, I think it's like 300 toddlers? You know, what are the experiments like and what are they trying to learn from this group?
They're trying to study this contextual memory again, rather than having them recall episodes, which there's been a lot of work on that, having people recall early episodes in their life. And like you were talking about earlier, you might be picking this stuff up from photos. So it's really hard to trust some of that data. So this is the first prospective study where they are giving toddlers these experiences and then seeing what they remember months later. And so they're having these kids learn when they're in a certain room that's got spaceships on the walls, for instance, one of the boxes has a toy. If they're in another room, it's a different box that has a toy. And so the kids can learn that, but they're not going to remember it very long. And so they're repeatedly doing these tasks over the course of months to see when do the kids start actually being able to remember those cues and that information. And the neat thing about this experiment is it can be replicated exactly in mice. So they're having mice do the same thing with bits of food, and they're going to be trying to figure out whether some of the brain activity, some of the patterns and characteristics that they're observing in the kids are observable in mice. And then they can start doing more invasive things with the mice to try and understand what's happening at the brain level in a way that you can't with humans.
Are we able to then pinpoint when these toddlers can suddenly start remembering when they go into the space room, the toy is going to be in a specific box?
They're still early in the experiments, but they think right around 20 months is when this sort of switch occurs from being able to not remember anything to being able to remember things. So I should add that they call it infantile amnesia up to about age 3, where you really can't remember much of anything at all. But between age 3 and 10, they have what is called childhood amnesia, where their memories are pretty spotty.
Yeah.
And they're not very good at separating memories. A lot of things tend to run together, and that just gradually improves over the course of those years.
That's super interesting. Let's talk a little bit about the mouse experiments. You know, as you say, you can go a bit further. For example, you talked to some folks that use optogenetics, which is this ability to very finely control like certain neurons or certain regions of the brain. What are we learning from those types of experiments?
Yeah, so with the optogenetic experiments, what they're able to do is figure out exactly which neurons in the hippocampus, which is the part of the brain that processes memories, which neurons exactly are encoding that memory. It's sort of like a constellation of neurons. It's a set of them that will connect together and fire together, and that's what forms the memory, and they call that an engram. And so what they're able to do is to figure out when the baby mouse is first learning the task, let's say that the food is in the box over here, which cells are firing at that moment, and they can label those cells with a protein that then could be later activated. And so the baby mouse will go about his business. It'll forget how to do that. As an adult, it doesn't remember that either. But if the researchers shine a light in the brain, these light-sensitive engram cells will fire. And that causes the mouse to suddenly recall the memory and know where the food is again.
Mm. So that suggests that there is a way to access it, you know, a memory that was lost from infant amnesia or approximation of that.
Exactly. Now, it's a very artificial method. I don't know that everyone's entirely convinced this is evidence that this is what happens in nature and that we do all have these hidden engrams, but that's just going to take further research to sort out.
So you talk a little bit about the role of neurogenesis, growing our brains, growing neurons in our brain, that it might have in forgetting. So, you know, how would that work and how is that being tested?
Yes, that's one of several hypotheses for what's happening. And the idea is that these engrams, they're being formed. So like we were talking about earlier, it's not that the brain can't form these memories. It can do it just fine. We just can't access them. And so the idea here is that forgetting, whether that's forgetting your childhood memories or forgetting where you left your car keys, could just be a function of an engram being written over with a new engram, with neurons that the brain decides are more important. First one's still there. It's just not the one that's preferred at that point. Where that comes in with infantile amnesia is that, like you were saying earlier, the brain is growing really fast, learning all kinds of things, lots and lots of neuron growth that's happening as well. And so once that starts to slow down, maybe the brain is better at keeping things rather than constantly writing over them.
So what happens if you interfere with neurogenesis? Does that affect early memories?
In this particular experiment, if they block neurogenesis, then they also seem to block infantile amnesia.
Have they tried any other ways to block the loss of memories from baby mice?
There's a few ways that can be done. And one paper that was out in Science Advances last year found that if they infect the mother mouse when she's pregnant with a protein that sort of mimics like a viral infection, the baby mice, the males only for some reason, are less likely to have infantile amnesia. They seem to be able to form memories much earlier. It's not entirely clear why that is. Could be that some immune cells in the brain seem to be implicated. They might be affecting how the brain is developing overall or how certain connections are being formed between neurons. But a lot of that's very early days still.
But that does suggest that maybe there are some people that had adverse effects when they were really little or when they were in utero that might actually have these super early memories.
Yeah. There is some sort of parallel evidence to that as well, that in animals, if you separate them from their mothers, for instance, their brains seem to mature earlier. And whether or not that's a good thing for the rest of their lives, we don't really know. Those animals seem to have higher levels of anxiety. And we know in humans in so many ways, those first few years of life are so crucial for forming your personality, forming your mental abilities. So it kind of makes sense that if that maturation process is sped up or interfered with in some ways, there could be some really lasting effects that are difficult, if not impossible, to reverse.
Looking across all these different experiments that you report on, do you feel like they're getting closer to the answer to the why question? You know, why might we not remember this stuff?
Yeah, there's several varying ideas. I think a lot of them come down to what the brain finds important. It's more important at that stage in your life, unless you're a guinea pig, because you can depend on your parents, it's more important at that stage in your life to be learning about the world in general, to be learning what a cat is versus remembering I live next door to this particular orange cat. So you can forget about the orange cat, but you remember the word for cat. You remember what all the things associated with it. And you could kind of focus more on finding patterns than having individual memories.
I really like this idea that you talk about in your story where there is this kind of huge capacity in the infant brain that we just can't even conceive of as adults. Like there's just big differences in it. And that might be one of the reasons that we're not able to access those memories.
Infant brains go through a number of what are called critical periods. The example I always think about is like learning a language, for instance. We know that kids can learn a language so much more easily than adults do. That's because their brain is just very plastic, can pick up all sorts of things. And that critical period, they say it closes at a certain age. And after that point, you really can't reopen it. And your brain will never be that plastic and malleable again. And memory formation seems to be a similar thing where your brain is going along, picking up all sorts of things, forming these memories in a very different way than it will later on in life. And so there's a lot of research into that as well, like what is happening during these critical periods that's changing how the brain matures. And you were talking about like the experiences too. There's some research finding that depending on the experiences you have during that critical period, the brain will mature faster or in different ways than if you had a different set of experiences. So it really all comes down to just how crucial those first few years are.
Infantile amnesia is an interesting puzzle, definitely something that I could just keep talking about for hours. But could we talk a little bit about how learning the why of it, the how of it, you know, what can we do with that information to either look at how adults forget or remember or, you know, other things that we also care about?
There could be some implications for early childhood learning, like preschool, daycare, even. What's it worth teaching children at this age? Should we be teaching them music? Do we have to be fighting to get them into the best preschool? One researcher I talked to said that she'd written a column for the New York Times where for grandparents, so grandparents were concerned that their grandchildren might not remember them if they died too young. Oh. So how could you get your kids to be able to remember their grandparents? But there's this broader question too, which is very controversial over whether infantile amnesia, this kind of forgetting, is similar to the forgetting we do as adults. And we talked about the neurogenesis, for instance, and that whole idea is very controversial. But if it is the same kind of forgetting, we might be able to understand that a little bit better by studying this sort of as a model. There's some evidence, for instance, that during Alzheimer's, of course, your brain gets all of these plaques that just completely tear up its integrity and make it impossible to remember anything. But even before those start forming, people start forgetting things, and we're not entirely sure what's happening at that point. If we do understand this better, we might be able to start getting some clues into whether those memories are still there and just not accessible before the brain starts accumulating all of this damage. I do want to say that there's a lot of different hypotheses floating around, and they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. There could be some neurogenesis going on at certain points. There could be these critical periods opening and closing in ways that we don't fully understand just yet. But the fact that we have these optogenetic techniques, we're getting better at human brain imaging as well with younger and younger children. We might really start to be learning a lot more about this and answering some of these questions over the next few years.
This really reminds me of sleep research. You know, it's something that is omnipresent in our lives, and we just never think about how like technical it is and what it's doing and, you know, how important it is. We just don't know. You know, there's just so much to learn about. That's such a basic piece of human biology. It's really interesting.
One of the researchers I barely quoted in here is doing stuff on naps and whether kids who give up naps at certain ages might have more or less mature brains and might be more useful to teach them French if they've stopped napping on their own, but only those kids who've already stopped napping.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, it's all very new, but I thought it was really interesting.
Wow, that's really cool.
I just remember being forced to take naps and just reading under my covers. That's my earliest memory.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much, Sarah, for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Sarah Reardon is a freelance science journalist. You can find a link to the story we discussed at science.org/podcast. Stay tuned for a chat with researcher Hui Quan Lee about how fear after acute stress lingers in the brain. This week's episode is brought to you in part by the Eppendorf and Science Prize for Neurobiology. Are you or one of your colleagues doing great neuroscience? If so, then we encourage you to apply for the prestigious Eppendorf and Science Prize for Neurobiology, an international prize which honors young scientists for outstanding neurobiological research based on methods of molecular, cellular, systems, or organismic biology. Submissions are due June 15th. Visit science.org/Eppendorf to apply today. Generalized fear is a symptom in some anxiety disorders, in panic disorder or social anxiety or PTSD. Generalized fear is basically reacting in a fearful way to events or environments that don't relate specifically to the original stressors from the past. There are plenty of cues around suggesting that there's no danger, but you still feel afraid. This generalized fear can cause stress and reduce quality of life. And we don't know much about how to turn it off, but we are learning about how it might get turned on. This Week in Science, Hui Quan Lee and colleagues wrote about changes in the brain linked with the onset of generalized fear. Hi, Hui Quan. Welcome to the Science Podcast.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for having me here.
Sure. Let's talk a little bit about the work you did here. It was in mice and also in some postmortem brains. So let's start with what's happening with the mice. Going into this work, you had an idea of where in the brain
this switch might be happening, where generalized fear might be starting, but not the specifics of how this change occurs. In order to get at those details, you looked at mouse brains across a variety of conditions. What were the different setups for the mice? How were they set up to experience generalized fear?
We used a mouse model and used a foot shock as the stressor to trigger fear in mice. And we observed conditioned fear and generalized fear were produced after this foot shock.
In some cases, the mouse would go into a space and get shocked, and then it would never want to go back to that specific spot. It would freeze. It would be afraid of going back there. That's kind of the basic fear response, right? But then generalized fear is something a little bit different in a mouse.
Exactly. In the same environment, this type of fear is called conditioned fear. But generalized fear is that the mice were put into a novel environment. They have never been experiencing any stress in those environments, but they still show fearful response. As you said, that is generalized fear.
So in this setup, you have one condition that gives you fear specific to a specific environment. And then you have another setup where you get generalized fear. And that means that the mice are afraid in different environments, novel places. So when you looked at the neurons in this region that you knew was important to generalized fear, how is it different after generalized fear had been induced in these mice? Tell us about the brain region and the changes that you saw there.
We observed neurotransmitter changes in a brain region called dorsal raphe, that is in the midbrain. And we observed that the serotonergic neurons in this region changed their co-transmitter from glutamate into GABA.
Let's break that down real quick. There are basically co-transmitters. So there's two kinds of neurotransmitters being released by these neurons.
Exactly. So they have serotonin as their major transmitter, and they co-release glutamate.
And when they were in the generalized fear condition, you saw a switch for that co-transmitter from glutamate to GABA. Is that right?
Yes. And when we block the switch from glutamate to GABA, we observed that the generalized fear was blocked.
Yeah. So this was all in mice. You were able to show, you know, this relationship between the neurotransmitter expression and generalized fear. What did you see in the human postmortem tissue that you were able to look at?
We observed a similar increase in the serotoninergic neurons co-expressing GABA synthesis in the individuals of PTSD compared to the control subjects. Similarly, as what we have found in mice, the correlation and causality between the neurotransmitter switch and the generalized fear production was demonstrated in the mouse model. In human, we have found this correlation. The causality is hard to be investigated.
Yeah, because you have to go deep into the midbrain, find this very specific region of neurons and say, oh, did you change what neurotransmitter you're dealing with? That's not easy to do in people at all.
Exactly.
Yeah. One of the things that you administered to the mice to see if you could block this progression to the different neurotransmitters, this switch in this region of the brain, was Prozac. So that worked on the mice, but there was somewhat of a limitation on the timing.
True. When we provide Prozac immediately after the foot shock, 2 weeks later, the generalized fear was gone, was not observed for these mice. But when we provided Prozac 2 weeks after the foot shock, when the fear response is already produced, there was no effect.
So it's not reversing the switch. It might prevent it from happening. So you showed that there's a switch in the neurotransmitters in this region of the brain. What happens next? So what are the downstream effects of these neurotransmitters being different? You know, how do we know that that might translate into generalized fear? What are some suspected mechanisms there?
We have identified two brain regions downstream of dorsal raphe. One of them is central amygdala. The other one is lateral hypothalamus.
So these two regions that you found downstream, you did see changes in their neurotransmitter setup, if you will. What do we know about the central amygdala and the lateral hypothalamus? You know, are these regions associated with fear in other settings?
Yes, they have been studied by other researchers that they have a role in fear regulation or anxiety-related behavior.
So let's go to the other end. Before we get to the switch in neurotransmitters in the dorsal raft in the midbrain, what do we know about the causes from that? How do we go from fear, you know, a foot shock, to a change in neurotransmitters?
We have identified that stress hormones play a role in producing generalized fear, particularly when we have blocked the synthesis of corticosterone, that is a stress hormone. When we blocked its production, we were able to block the transmitter switch as well as generalize the fear.
So how do you see this research going forward and being integrated into therapies or interventions for generalized fear?
I think our study have pointed two directions. One is with existing therapies. Our study has suggested that earlier intervention is likely to produce better effect. And for chronic PTSD or similar fear-related disorders, it may be hard when the patients have already a long history of the disease. Then our study suggests new therapeutic target to treat this disease.
Yeah. Were you surprised that neurons would switch which neurotransmitters they used? I don't know. When I took neurophysiology, for some reason, we didn't really talk about neurons switching up which neurotransmitters it would use. We kind of were like, okay, this is the one that you use. This is your destiny. Were you surprised that these neurons were able to change which co-neurotransmitters they were releasing?
Yes. So for a very long history, like in classical neurobiology, people believe neurons have only a single neurotransmitter throughout their life and their neurotransmitter is fixed. But recently, in the last few decades, more and more evidence supports that neurons do not express only one neurotransmitter, and surprisingly, they can switch their transmitter. The Spitzer lab and at UCSD, as well as other labs who work on neurotransmitter switching, have now accumulated vast evidence in different brain regions in response to different stimuli that neurons have the ability to switch their neurotransmitters. And what is more important is that this switch contributes to behavior changes.
So this plasticity has an effect, you know, all the way at what we do or what we think or how we feel.
Right.
Very cool. Thank you so much, Hui Quan.
Thank you, Sarah.
Hui Quan Li works as a senior scientist at Neurocrine Biosciences in San Diego. When she was doing the work for this paper, she was an assistant project scientist in the School of Biological Sciences and Center for Neural Circuits and Behavior at the University of California, San Diego. And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions, write to us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. To find us on a podcasting app, search for Science Magazine. Or you can listen on our website, science.org/podcast. This show was edited by me, Sarah Crespi, and Kevin McLean, with production help from Megan Tuck at Podigy. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. On behalf of Science and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us. You listen to us to hear about new discoveries in science, but did you know we're a part of the American Association for the Advancement of Science? AAAS is a nonprofit publisher and a science society. When you join AAAS, you help support our mission to advance science for the benefit of all. Become a AAAS member at the silver level or above to receive a year's subscription to Science and an exclusive gift. Join today by visiting AAAS.org/join. That's AAAS.org/join.